For Valentine's Day, we're dusting off a show from February 2009. It has some decidedly kinky music and a great expose of the diamond industry. So put down that Whitman's sampler, turn up the volume, and hugs and kisses to all. Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Valentine's Day is coming to town. Most pinko commie left-of-center radio programs are probably drowning you with stories about how exploitative, polluting, and downright awful the chocolate industry is. But that's not our way. For Valentine's Day, New World Notes wants to promote love, romance, and great S-blank-X with your sweetie, or if that's not possible with someone else's. So instead of a damning expose of big chocolate, we'll present a tender and heartwarming tale of the diamond monopoly and the U.S. advertising agency that keeps it in business and keeps it in your pocket or your fiancé's, depending on your gender. Lynn Gary gives a fine reading of an article on the subject by Edward J. Epstein. And in between sections, we'll pause for romantic songs of love. In fact, let's start out with one. Tom Lehrer's She's My Girl.
Sharks gotta swim, and bats gotta fly. I gotta love one woman till I die. To Ed or Dick or Bob, she may be just a slob, but to me, well, she's my girl. In winter, the bedroom is one large ice cube, and she squeezes the toothpaste from the middle of the tube. Her hair's in the sink, have driven me to drink, but she's my girl. She's my girl. She's my girl, and I love her. The girl that I lament for, the girl my money's spent for, the girl my back is bent for, the girl I owe the rent for, the girl I gave up Lent for, is the girl that heaven meant for me. So though for breakfast she makes coffee that tastes like shampoo, I come home for dinner and get peanut butter stew. Or if I'm in luck, it's broiled hockey puck. But oh well, what the hell, she's my girl, and I love her.
An astonishing article I came across quite by accident on the internet that demonstrates how corporations use the PR industry to manufacture ideas of value and even create phony cultural traditions. The article was published in 1982 in the Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein, and titled, Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond? He writes, the diamond invention, the creation of the idea that diamonds are rare and valuable and are essential signs of esteem, is a relatively recent development in the history of the diamond trade. Until the late 19th century, diamonds were found only in a few riverbeds in India and in the jungles of Brazil, and the entire world production of gem diamonds amounted to a few pounds a year. In 1870, however, huge diamond mines were discovered near the Orange River in South Africa, where diamonds were soon being scooped out by the ton. Suddenly, the market was deluged with diamonds. The British financiers who had organized the South African mines quickly realized that their investment was endangered. Diamonds had little intrinsic value, and their price depended almost entirely on their scarcity. The financiers feared that when the new mines were developed in South Africa, Diamonds would become, at best, only semi-precious gems. The major investors in the diamond mines realized that they had no alternative but to merge their interests into a single entity that would be powerful enough to control production and perpetuate the illusion of scarcity of diamonds. The instrument they created in 1888 was called De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited, incorporated in South Africa. De Beers proved to be the most successful cartel arrangement in the annals of modern commerce. While other commodities, such as gold, silver, copper, rubber, and grains, fluctuated wildly in response to economic conditions, diamonds have continued, with few exceptions, to advance upward in price every year since the Depression. The diamond invention is far more than a monopoly for fixing diamond prices. It is a mechanism for converting tiny crystals of carbon into universally recognized tokens of wealth, power, and romance. Both women and men had to be made to perceive diamonds not as marketable precious stones, but as an inseparable part of courtship and married life. The illusion had to be created that diamonds were forever, forever, in the sense that they should never be resold. In September of 1938, Harry Oppenheimer, son of the founder of De Beers and then 29, traveled from Johannesburg to New York City to meet with Gerald M. Lauck, president of N.W. Ayer, a leading advertising agency in the United States. Lauck and N.W. Ayer had been recommended to Oppenheimer by the Morgan Bank, which had helped his father consolidate De Beers' financial empire. His bankers were concerned about the price of diamonds, which had declined worldwide. In Europe, where diamond prices had collapsed during the Depression, there seemed little possibility of restoring public confidence in diamonds. Furthermore, Europe was on the verge of war, and there seemed little possibility of expanding diamond sales. This left the United States as the only real market for De Beers diamonds. Oppenheimer and the bankers believed that an advertising campaign could persuade Americans to buy more expensive diamonds. Oppenheimer suggested to Lauck that his agency prepare a plan for creating a new image for diamonds among Americans. In their subsequent investigation of the American diamond market, the staff of N.W. Ayer found that since the end of World War I in 1919, the total amount of diamonds sold in America, measured in carats, had declined by 50%. An Ayer memo concluded that the depressed state of the market for diamonds was, quote, the result of the economy, changes in social attitudes, and the promotion of competitive luxuries, close quote. Specifically, the Ayer study stressed the need to strengthen the association in the public's mind of diamonds with romance. Since, quote, young men buy over 90% of all engagement rings, it would be crucial to inculcate in them the idea that diamonds were a gift of love. The larger and finer the diamond, the greater the expression of love. Similarly, young women had to be encouraged to view diamonds as an integral part of any romantic courtship. Since the Ayer plan to romanticize diamonds required subtly altering the public's picture of the way a man courts and wins a woman, the advertising agency strongly suggested exploiting the relatively new medium of motion pictures. Movie idols, the paragons of romance for the mass audience, would be given diamonds to use as their symbols of indestructible love. In addition, the agency suggested offering stories and society photographs to selected magazines and newspapers, which would reinforce the link between diamonds and romance. Fashion designers would talk on radio programs about the trend towards diamonds that Ayer planned to start. The Ayer plan also envisioned using the British royal family to help foster the romantic allure of diamonds. An Ayer memo said, quote, since Great Britain has such an important interest in the diamond industry, The royal couple could be of tremendous assistance to this British industry by wearing diamonds rather than other jewels, close quote. Queen Elizabeth later went on a well-publicized trip to several South African diamond mines, and she accepted a diamond from Oppenheimer. In addition to putting these plans into action, N.W. Ayer placed a series of lush four-color advertisements in magazines that were presumed to mold elite opinion, featuring reproductions of famous paintings by artists such as Picasso, Durant, Dalí, and Dufy. The advertisements were intended to convey the idea that diamonds, like paintings, were unique works of art. By 1941, the advertising agency reported to its client that it had already achieved impressive results in its campaign. The sale of diamonds had increased by 55% in the United States since 1938. N.W. Ayer noted also that its campaign had required, quote, the conception of a new form of advertising, which has been widely imitated ever since. There was no direct sale to be made. There was no brand name to be impressed on the public mind. There was simply an idea, the eternal emotional value surrounding the diamond. And a new color, diamond blue, was created and used in these campaigns, close quote. In its 1947 strategy plan, the advertising agency strongly emphasized a psychological approach. Quote, we are dealing with a problem in mass psychology. We seek to strengthen the tradition of the diamond engagement ring to make it a psychological necessity capable of competing successfully at the retail level with utility goods and services, close quote. It defined as its target audience some 70 million people, 15 years and over, whose opinion we hope to influence in support of our objectives. N.W. Ayer outlined a subtle program that included arranging for lecturers to visit high schools across the country. Quote, all of these lectures revolve around the diamond engagement ring and are reaching thousands of girls in their assemblies, classes and informational meetings in our leading educational institutions. The agency had organized in 1946 a weekly service called Hollywood Personalities, which provided 125 leading newspapers with descriptions of the diamonds worn by movie stars. In 1947, the agency commissioned a series of portraits of engaged socialites. The idea was to create prestigious role models for the poorer middle-class wage earners. We spread the word of diamonds worn by stars of screen and stage, by wives and daughters of political leaders, by any woman who can make the grocer's wife and the mechanic's sweetheart say, I wish I had what she has, close quote. An N.W. Ayer copywriter came up with a caption, a diamond is forever, which was scrawled on the bottom of a picture of two young lovers on a honeymoon. Even though diamonds can in fact be shattered, chipped, discolored, or incinerated to ash, the concept of eternity perfectly captured the magical qualities that the advertising agency wanted to attribute to diamonds. Within a year, a diamond is forever became the official motto of De Beers.
As we danced to the Wiener Schnitzel waltz, the music was gay and the setting was Viennese. Your hair wore some roses, or perhaps they were peonies. I was blind to your obvious faults. As we danced across the scene to the strains of the Wiener Schnitzel waltz, some champagne from your shoe, la la la. I was drunk by the time I got through, la la la. For I didn't know, as I raised that cup, it had taken two bottles to fill the thing up. It was I who stepped on your dress, la la la. The skirts all came off, I confess, la la la. Revealing for all of the others to see just what it was that endeared you to me. I remember the night I held you so tight as we danced to the Wiener Schnitzel waltz. Your lips were like wine, if you'll pardon the simile. The music was lovely and quite Rudolph Frimley. I drank wine, you drank chocolate malts. And we both turned quite green to the strains of the Wiener Schnitzel waltz.
Thank you again, Tom Lehrer. So, the world's most successful cartel ever kept the price of diamonds way high. The English imperialists saw a potentially huge market, but only in America. This potential market was transformed into a real market by a brilliant advertising agency, NWAR, which created a blitz of highly sophisticated and then unusual ad techniques to make diamonds seem desirable, glamorous, an eternal symbol of enduring love, particularly their cash cow, the diamond engagement ring. Even Queen Elizabeth aided the campaign. How many married women do you know that do not wear a diamond engagement ring? And all of the above was first engineered before TV. Then comes the boob tube, and you can imagine the new possibilities. NWAR agency did. Then Russia joined the cartel, and disaster threatened to strike. Here, disaster means lower prices. Can the cartel survive? Let's listen.
In 1951, NWAR found some resistance to its million-dollar publicity blitz. It noted in its annual strategy review, quote, "The millions of brides and brides-to-be are subjected to at least two important pressures that work against the diamond engagement ring. Among the more prosperous, there is the sophisticated urge to be different as a means of being smart. The lower-income groups would like to show more for the money than they can find in the diamond they can afford." Close quote. To remedy these problems, the advertising agency argued, quote, "It is essential that these pressures be met by the constant publicity to show that only the diamond is everywhere accepted and recognized as the symbol of betrothal." Close quote. NWAR was always searching for new ways to influence American public opinion. Not only did it organize a service to, quote, "release to the women's pages the engagement ring," but it set about exploiting the relatively new medium of television by arranging for actresses and other celebrities to wear diamonds when they appeared before the camera. It also established a diamond information center that placed a stamp of quasi-authority on the flood of, quote, "historical data" and, quote, "news" it released. NWAR commented in a memorandum to De Beers, "Because we have done it successfully, we have opportunities to help with articles originated by others." Close quote. NWAR proposed to apply to the diamond market Thorsten Veblen's idea, stated in The Theory of the Leisure Class, that Americans were motivated in their purchases not by utility but by conspicuous consumption. Quote, "The substantial diamond gift can be made a more widely sought symbol of personal and family success, an expression of socioeconomic achievement," close quote, NWAR said in a report. To exploit this desire for conspicuous display, the agency specifically recommended, quote, "Promote the diamond as one material object which can reflect, in a very personal way, a man's success in life," close quote. Since this campaign would be addressed to upwardly mobile men, the advertisements ideally, quote, "should have the aroma of tweed, old leather, and polished wood, which is characteristic of a good club," close quote. Toward the end of the 1950s, NWAR reported to De Beers that 20 years of advertisements and publicity had had a pronounced effect on the American psyche. Quote, "Since 1939, an entirely new generation of young people has grown to marriageable age. To this new generation, a diamond ring is considered a necessity to engagements by virtually everyone." Close quote. In America, which remained the most important market for most of De Beers' diamonds, N.W. Ayres recognized the need to create a new demand for diamonds among long married couples. Candies come, flowers come, furs come, but such ephemeral gifts fail to satisfy a woman's psychological craving for a renewal of the romance, N.W. Ayres said in a report. An advertising campaign could instill the idea that the gift of a second diamond in the later years of marriage would be accepted as a sign of ever-growing love. The diamond market had to be further restructured in the mid-1960s to accommodate a surfeit of minute diamonds, which De Beers undertook to market for the Soviets. They had discovered diamond mines in Siberia after intensive exploration in the 1950s. De Beers and its allies no longer controlled the diamond supply and realized that open competition with the Soviets would inevitably lead, as Harry Oppenheimer gingerly put it, to price fluctuations, which would weaken the carefully cultivated confidence of the public in the value of diamonds. Oppenheimer, assuming that neither party could afford risking the destruction of the diamond invention, offered the Soviets a straightforward deal, a single channel for controlling the world supply of diamonds. In accepting this arrangement, the Soviets became partners in the cartel and co-protectors of the diamond invention. Almost all of the Soviet diamonds were under half a carat in their uncut form, and there was no ready retail outlet for millions of such tiny diamonds. When it made its secret deal with the Soviet Union, De Beers had expected production from Siberian mines to decrease gradually. Instead, production accelerated at an incredible pace, and De Beers was forced to reconsider its sales strategy. De Beers ordered N.W. Ayres to reverse one of its themes. Women were no longer to be led to equate the status and emotional commitment to an engagement ring with the sheer size of the diamond. A strategy for small diamond sales was outlined, stressing the importance of quality, cut, and color over size. Pictures of 1/4-carat rings would replace pictures of up to 2-carat rings. The news release also made clear that women should think of diamonds, regardless of size, as objects of perfection. A small diamond could be just as perfect as a large diamond. De Beers devised the Eternity Ring, made up of as many as 25 tiny Soviet diamonds, which could be sold to an entirely new market of older married women. The advertising campaign was based on the theme of recaptured love. Again, sentiments were born out of necessity. Older American women received a ring of miniature diamonds because of the needs of a South African corporation to accommodate the Soviet Union. And I've been reading from an article, "Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond?" published in the 1982 Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein. So there you have it. How a cartel and an advertising agency used the media to create a phony cultural tradition in the interest of profit. Thank you for listening.
Hello.
from 1970, The Kinks' Immortal Lola, the rockingest song about transgender love for decades. And thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the fine reading of the Diamond article, many thanks to Lynn Gurry and the Unwelcome Guests Collective. www.unwelcomeguests.net. New World Notes is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's an archive of shows you can download. There's also a weekly newsletter and a blog. All is free. For more information, why not start at the blog? We're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program are mine alone, and they are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, happy Valentine's Day, and advising illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and please tune in again.